Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Alfred de Zayas, professor of law at the Geneva School of Diplomacy and former UN rapporteur, who explains why he believes that the continued imposition of U.S. sanctions against Venezuela and Iran amid the coronavirus pandemic constitutes a crime against humanity. Richard Eskow, senior advisor for health and economic justice with the group Social Security Works, who assesses the $2 trillion congressional pandemic rescue package and responds to conservatives calling for the sacrifice of older workers. And Reverend Jim Wallace, an author, preacher, justice advocate, and founder of Sojourners Magazine, who reminds us of the working men and women in our nation who are bearing the heaviest burden during this coronavirus crisis. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Trump Secretary of State Mike Pompeo cut $1 billion in U.S. aid to Afghanistan after efforts failed to settle the ongoing split between Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and opposition leader Abdullah Abdullah. Both men claim to have won last year's September 28th presidential election, which has hampered peace talks with the Taliban. The major cut in U.S. aid could trigger new instability inside Afghanistan's security forces at the same time the COVID-19 virus begins to ravage one of the world's poorest nations. Reuters reports that the Trump administration has threatened a further cut of $1 billion in aid if the split between the Afghan government is not resolved. The deep U.S. aid cut comes as the Taliban maintain control over half the country and regularly attack military outposts in many provinces. In response to the coronavirus, the government has closed stores in the capital city of Kabul, while the Taliban have sent 100 health teams to villages to promote healthy practices like washing hands. President Ghani warned that the Afghan army would not last 6 months in the face of deep U.S. cuts in military aid. The Trump regime signed a troop withdrawal deal with the Taliban in February, but progress and planned negotiations between the militant rebel group and the Afghan government has been delayed by the Taliban's demand for the release of 5,000 prisoners and the political feud between Ghani and Abdullah. Under pressure from the Trump administration, Colombia has stepped up military raids of coca plantations to reduce the nation's growing export of cocaine. At the same time, heavily armed police guard against angry coca farmers and drug gangs in order to protect drug eradication campaigns. Drug traffickers have planted landmines to impede military anti-coca sweeps, resulting in many deaths and injuries. The Economist reports that Colombia's right-wing president, Iván Duque, boasted of destroying 100,000 hectares of coca plants in 2019, twice as many as 2 years earlier. But today, coca production is expanding, with the export of the drug rising 8% last year. While Colombia continues to supply 70% of the world's cocaine, consumption of the drug in the United States surged over the last decade. According to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, 2 million Americans used the drug in 2018, up from 1.4 million in 2011. However, even if coca eradication did succeed, it would only boost prices and encourage more farmers to grow coca. During an early March meeting, President Trump demanded that Colombia resume herbicide spraying of coca fields. Aerial spraying was halted in 2015 after the World Health Organization found it to be a likely cause of cancer. The coronavirus pandemic has been a major windfall for increased business and profits for online retail giant Amazon. With retail stores across the world largely shut down, Amazon has pledged to hire 100,000 additional workers, increase pay, and offer paid time off in warehouses and distribution centers. However, Amazon workers complain that Amazon is shortchanging workers' safety, as staff in 10 Amazon distribution centers tested positive for COVID-19. At the same time, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos enriched himself by selling $3.4 billion worth of Amazon stock prior to the virus-induced Wall Street crash. According to In These Times magazine, Many Amazon workers are skeptical of the new benefits being offered, which could mean unwanted changes in their current benefit package. It's still unclear how the policy will apply in localities that already require paid sick leave. Chicago-area Amazon workers who say they previously caught the company breaking local sick leave law suspect the company is now trying to pull a bait-and-switch. The American Prospect observed that the hyper-efficient Amazon work culture could boost the spread of the coronavirus. Workers say that social distancing precautions, stand at least 6 feet apart, wash your hands frequently, avoid touching surfaces that might be contaminated, are almost impossible to follow inside crowded facilities now that the volume of packages they're handling has spiked. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
In the midst of the global COVID-19 pandemic, the residents of some nations that have been under U.S. economic sanctions face even steeper odds of weathering the crisis, as their health systems have been severely impacted by lack of access to medicines and life-saving equipment. This was true of Iraq all through the 1990s, and is the case today in Venezuela, Iran, and Syria. Cuba, despite President Trump's reimposition of some of the sanctions lifted by President Barack Obama, has developed over recent decades a strong health sector to the point that the island nation now exports medical personnel to countries struggling with the pandemic and is developing medicines that may prove the best defense against the coronavirus. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Alfred Desaias, professor of law at the Geneva School of Diplomacy. From 2012 to 2018, he served as the first United Nations independent expert for the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order. He asserts that sanctions imposed by one country on another are illegal under international law unless approved by the UN. In late 2017, he visited Venezuela, investigating the impact of U.S. and international sanctions on the South American nation's population. Here, Professor Desaias explains why he believes that continued U.S. sanctions imposed now, amid the coronavirus pandemic, constitutes a crime against humanity.
It's quite clear that when you impose sanctions on a country, that the population is going to suffer. I mean, it is ridiculous to pretend that the sanctions are only going to affect the government elite. Matter of fact, the government elite usually continues living rather well. It's the population, the most vulnerable women, children, who have to pay for the consequences of these illegal sanctions. Now, when I went to Venezuela in November, December 2017, the situation wasn't that bad. As a matter of fact, I went into supermarkets and I saw the supermarkets full. The point is that cumulatively, since the economic war started against Venezuela, and that is not just the sanctions from the time of Obama 2015 and Trump 2017, I'm talking about the economic war that has been waged against Venezuela since 1999. Well, that has had a cumulative effect, and that has been greater difficulty on the part of the government to obtain life-saving medicines. The question is distribution chains and all of that, which has been impacted very badly by the economic war. Even worse is the financial blockade. Financial blockade has made it almost impossible for the government of Venezuela to buy and sell, to transfer money. Since the banks fear enormous penalties from the Department of the Treasury if they deal with Venezuela, so essentially the banks dropped Venezuela as they dropped Syria, as they dropped Iran, etc., etc. as it's been said before, sanctions kill. I mean, sanctions are not innocent little inconveniences. Sanctions actually kill human beings.
Alfred de Zayas, last year, Jeffrey Sachs from Columbia University and Mark Weisbrot from the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington issued a report about the number of deaths in Venezuela the year before. Can you talk about that?
Approximately 40,000 Venezuelans died as a result of the sanctions. That is, because they didn't have access to medicines or didn't have timely access to medicines, or because they had, you know, malnutrition, et cetera, et cetera. So now imagine with the pandemic, with COVID-19. Now, the whole infrastructure in Venezuela, in Cuba, in Iran, in Syria, has been devastated by this economic war against them. So they're already weak. And then the United States wants to even make these sanctions worse. I mean, that is nothing less than a crime against humanity. In my own report to the Human Rights Council 2018, I explained why that adds up to a crime against humanity, susceptible to being prosecuted, investigated by the International Criminal Court in The Hague. And on the 13th of February of this year, the Venezuelan foreign minister personally presented to the ICC a complaint against these sanctions under Article 14 of the ICC statute, invoking Article 7. Article 7 is the article that defines crimes against humanity. Back in the year 2012, the then High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, issued a study, a thematic study on the adverse impacts of unilateral coercive measures. And she condemned unilateral coercive measures, asked that they be lifted, and explained why they violated international law. This is deliberate. I mean, this is intentional murder. As I said, sanctions kill, and it is for every American citizen, including myself, to protest. And I do protest at every possible occasion.
That was Alfred de Zayas, former UN rapporteur on the effect of sanctions on the people of Venezuela. For more perspectives on the legality and impact of U.S. economic sanctions around the world, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After weeks of negotiations, the Democratic-controlled House and Republican-led Senate agreed on a $2 trillion pandemic rescue package, the largest emergency aid package in U.S. history, signed by President Trump on March 27th, aims to provide temporary relief to American workers, small businesses, and major industries who are struggling to cope with an economy frozen in place by the deadly COVID-19 pandemic. Among the provisions in the stimulus bill are direct payments of $1,200 each to individuals who earn $75,000 in adjusted gross income or less. Married couples earning up to $150,000 will receive $2,400 and an additional $500 for each child. The legislation also allocates billions of dollars in aid to hard-hit hospitals in state and local governments responding to contain and treat the coronavirus. While a $500 billion fund was set up to provide loans to the nation's largest corporations, President Trump stated he would ignore a key provision in the package, requiring an inspector general to oversee how this $500 billion is spent. Your reporter spoke with Richard Eskow, senior advisor for health and economic justice with the group Social Security Works and host of the Zero Hour on Free Speech TV. Here, Eskow, who's suffering from a chronic health condition that makes him vulnerable to the coronavirus, takes a critical look at the corporate bailout fund in the rescue package and responds to conservative politicians who are calling on older workers to sacrifice themselves to save the U.S. economy.
It's absolute sleight of hand and fakery, and it's a criticism of our media establishment that more people don't know that. The $500 billion for corporations is a fraction of the giveaway to corporate America in this bill. It also creates a $4.5 trillion Federal Reserve Fund with no oversight that is able to lend not just, you know, in the traditional way, which is bad enough to banks through a discount window, is able to lend directly to corporations. So what you really have is at least a $5 trillion. Trump's advisor Larry Kudlow says it's $6 trillion. You have $5 trillion for corporations. Then you have $1.5, give or take, trillion for everybody else, of which workers will probably get, and working families, less than 10% of the total. So of the total pie. So what you're really and by the way, I have to say that Trump's proclamation that he wouldn't even let the sort of somewhat toothless congressional oversight take place. If there was anything I could have predicted with 100% accuracy, if I'd had the wherewithal, I would have put some money on it. It was the most predictable event in the world. And it's going to be managed by Steve Mnuchin, who, before he became Treasury Secretary, ran one of the most predatory mortgage operations in history. And that's like being, you know, the meanest gangster at the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. It literally kicked an older woman out of her home for an underpayment of something like $1.22 on her monthly mortgage. So, you know, the guy who, you know, cartoon villain is going to be running this thing. It's the Federal Reserve will have no oversight, and you know, I hope Congress passes tighter restraints and more for workers in the you know, the weeks and months to come. But candidly, corporate America was desperate until this happened. So, in my opinion, they've kind of traded away their leverage. You know, right up front with this initial move. And candidly, I think that corporations will get more than even this $5.5 or $5 trillion before this is all over. So we're really talking about, at a time when the system of corporate capitalism failed, the most massive wealth transfer in human history from already beleaguered working people to corporations is underway.
Richard, I did want to ask you to comment on your recent article titled, "No, I Will Not Die for This Damned Economy." And that's a reference to some Trump supporters, including Republican Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who infamously said that older people, including himself, should sacrifice their lives during this coronavirus to get the country back to work and make sure that the economy doesn't sink while we're all locked down. Tell us a little bit about your response to
Patrick. Well, first of all, what I didn't write in the piece is that if Dan Patrick wants to sacrifice himself for this economy, you know, knock yourself out, Dan. But for me personally, what Dan Patrick said was those of us who are 70 plus, which is not me, but is Dan Patrick, will take care of ourselves, but don't sacrifice this country. Don't ruin this great America. What Dan Patrick is saying is that he's willing to die for an economy whose levels of inequality have not been seen since the Great Depression and possibly before, and that's before the pandemic hit. It's going to be much worse now. So Dan Patrick, who's done well for himself as a conservative talk show host and then politician, says, I don't believe him, but he says he's willing to die for this economy. You know what? I'm not. I'm not willing to die for Dan Patrick's wealth, Jeff Bezos's wealth, Bill Gates's wealth, Donald Trump's wealth. You know, what I'm willing to die for, if it comes to that, is a country where nobody lives without the basic goods of life, a country that has a social contract, a country that values everyone equally. And if the end result is that they wanted to open up retail a few weeks early, and for some reason that, you know, kills somebody I love or me, they're going to hear about it, because this is not an economy worth fighting for or dying for. It's an economy worth changing.
That was Richard Eskow, senior advisor for health and economic justice with the group Social Security Works, and host of The Zero Hour on Free Speech TV. Find links to his recent articles on the pandemic, published in his COVID Days Journal, written from the perspective of a high-risk individual, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As 30 states across the U.S. have issued stay-at-home directives to enforce social distancing practices in order to slow the spread of the coronavirus, the economy has come to a screeching halt. While Congress passed a $2 trillion rescue package, that aid will only provide inadequate and temporary relief for working families, many who were already living close to the edge when the pandemic struck. Many in Congress have recognized that it must quickly provide additional assistance to bridge the gap. But the targeted assistance won't benefit the nation's millions of undocumented workers who produce our food, provide health care, and assist the sick and elderly. Amazon, Instacart, and Whole Foods workers concerned about their own safety in the midst of this deadly virus have organized protests and strikes to demand improved workplace safety and benefits including hazard pay and sick pay. At the same time, the pandemic has exposed the gaping holes in our nation's social safety net and the widening gap between the rich and poor. President Trump has used his megaphone to scapegoat immigrants, the Chinese, and others he blames for his own failures of leadership. Your reporter spoke with Reverend Jim Wallace, an author, preacher, justice advocate, and founder of Sojourners magazine, who reminds us of the working men and women in our nation who are bearing the heaviest burden during this public health emergency.
This pandemic, this time, is going to reveal what's already true. And so it's not a matter of we'll be better or worse. This reveals who we are right now. It reveals our inequities, our relationships, our systemic realities that we have accepted for a long time and live with day to day. It's certainly anyone who's paying attention sees the inequities in our healthcare system, for example, in our economic systems of employment and lack thereof, in our educational system. So it's revealing who we are, and this is going to last for some time. So the question is, what will we see about ourselves and our society, our systems in this time? And will we care afterwards about what we've seen? It's showing us a lot. And that could change us if we allow ourselves to pay attention.
And Reverend Wallace, there are specific vulnerable populations at this moment, and that includes immigrants who've been the target of the Trump administration through ICE raids, mass sweeps, and the imprisonment of tens of thousands of people separated from their families, children in cages. And there's a lot of scapegoating going on before and during this pandemic. Tell us a bit about your concerns with the Trump administration and their resorting to scapegoatism at a moment of crisis that we're currently suffering through.
This morning I was reflecting on a biblical text, because that's what us reverends do. And in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 16, it says, redeem the time, for the days are evil. Redeem the time, for the days are evil. Before this coronavirus hit us, the days were evil in all kinds of ways. As you say, migrant kids separated from their parents and put in cages. People who live in fear every day, if they're a black church pastor, that their kids and their youth group will be racially policed even more. Or immigrant families who wonder if they'll be together at night. So many things, and yet now this virus has hit us and stopped us and made us go slower. And it's time to pay attention whether undocumented people in detention centers, for example, will be looked after and treated, whether all the people, as you say, in our prison system, how they will fare in a time like this. It's hard to social distance in prison. When this breaks into the global south, I was talking today to a friend who was on a conference call with church leaders all over the global south. If this is doing what it's doing to our hospital systems here, imagine the fragile and sometimes non-existent hospital systems in the global south, what this will do to them, and how do you social distance in refugee camps and all the barrios and the ghettos. So I think this can really show us, reveal what we have been either ignoring of or silent about for a long time. I also think redeeming the time could mean that we take this time to look at all that, Scott, which you're raising, to look at all that and look at ourselves. And we will be different. This will change us. This is a historical moment. It will change us. We don't know how yet, whether it will summon our better angels or our worst demons. These were evil days in this nation before the virus hit. They were evil days. Lack of compassion, lack of truth, lack of care. Our worst demons of racism and xenophobia were being evoked every day. And yet now we have time, perhaps, to redeem what this nation could become, but only if we open ourselves to the kind of change that what we've seen can lead us toward.
That was Reverend Jim Wallace, an author, preacher, justice advocate, and founder of Sojourners magazine. His most recent book is titled Christ in Crisis: Why We Need to Reclaim Jesus. Find his recent articles addressing the coronavirus pandemic by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KMEC in Ukiah, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.